deter them from that lifestyle. But, and of course, it's up to them, too. So it's not a total foolproof, but it gives them an alternative. And, you know, there's some, you know, that have difficulties. You know, they might have a mild disability, or they could have other troubles in their lives. They need alternative types of education. Sometimes the school model is not the only model. You know, sometimes, you know, it's a more holistic type of model that they need. And then they can move back, you know, to the school system. Sometimes they got to get that something out of their system. And they got to feel proud about themselves. And, you know, it's worked well for me. And, you know, some of them will move off to other specialties or other activities, other careers. But that's fine. They'll still have those tools, that knowledge behind them, and then that pride in the culture.
Kiliata Christian White's legacy is further cemented by the works of his apprentices, who have taken his traditional teachings and shaped a bold new future for Haida art.
Haida art is going in many directions. We have some artists working in Haida manga. We have artists that are working in filmmaking, graphic design, working in multi-graphic type of materials, you know, children's books, you know, incorporating the Haida language. And you also have a lot of people involved with the textiles. For the most part, I try to focus on the traditional parts first, and then once they're done with me, they could go any direction they want to go. And of course, you know, there's jewelry, there's weaving, you know, so there's many different directions we can go.
Kiliata Christian White, master Haida artist, runs until February 2026 at the Bill Reid Gallery of Northwest Coast Art in Vancouver. For CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, I'm Jesse Wentzloff. This report is made possible by funding from the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative and is available online with other stories from across the country at frequencynews.ca.
And thanks to Jesse Wentzloff for that report.
And it's free for if you're an SFU student. If you're like me, a non-student, it costs way too much money to go in there, $20. There's actually, Bill Reid did his work with the help of other people. I'll just say that. So did Rembrandt. Rembrandt, by the way. But I'll just leave it at that. There was a bit of a controversy with that. One thing, as a non-student or even as a student, go to the airport because that. What's the exact name of that?
I believe it's called the Jade Canoe. I think it's in the international side of the terminal.
Well, if you see that. And if you go there, just ask someone where it is. And it's rather big, and I think it's made out of jade, isn't it?
Yes, I believe so. It's a very large piece.
Yeah. So you're going to see a major work of Haida art.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Quite an amazing piece. And 20 bucks is a lot, although everything is expensive these days, and I'm sure it's...
I'm not going there, Magnus.
Expensive to run the gallery. But, as Liam was telling us, if you're a student, bring your student ID and you can attend the gallery for free, which is a great perk for students. All right. We have another report from our friends up in Prince George. This is from another station. And it is about... job fraud. So listen to this and make sure you, if you're out there looking for work, protect yourself.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or CFUR.ca. We've come to understand through a recent RCMP press release that there have been some fraudulent job postings happening in our community. We're with Corporal Jennifer Cooper at the RCMP detachment. Jennifer, can you tell us a little bit about the breakdown of how this scam or deception works. There's typically a check being sent to the individual who has supposedly successfully gotten this job position. And how does that work?
Yeah, so if I was the potential person seeking a job, I would answer the ad and say, yes, please hire me. They'd say, okay, what we're going to do first is send you a check. We need you to cash it. And they'll give you some sob story about why they're unable to cash the check on their end. They'll send you the check. You agree, sure, I can cash that for you. You cash it in your bank. You then e-transfer them back some money, or perhaps send it in the mail, send a bulk of the cash back to them, and too late for you or the bank to do anything about it, you find out that that was a fraudulently cashed check, and you are now out all of that money that you cashed into your bank account in the first place.
Do you know where they're coming from? Are they originating from Prince George itself, or does it seem to be that they're targeted at our community?
It would seem that they're more targeted at our community. These job posts were found on online job posting websites, so the original poster, the person looking for an employee, could be anywhere, and they just happen to be targeting Prince George with some of their advertising or where they're spending their dollars currently to have these jobs pop up.
What is the nature of these job descriptions? Is there a particular role that people are presumably looking to fill, or are they, you know, every position under the rainbow?
I don't think there's been any pattern to them, likely more online or nothing with a concrete building. So you're not going to find someone from like a large retail outlet posting these jobs and then you getting sucked in fraudulently. Although on the Canadian Anti-Fraud website, there has been reports of some things like that happening, but mostly this is going to be more, do you want to work from home or flexible work hours, much more ambiguous job ad.
So the communications and perhaps the interview process itself isn't being conducted in a brick and mortar setting in person necessarily.
That's correct. You'd likely more find these to be completely online based application and job acceptance kind of orientations, that sort of thing. So we're just wanting the public to know that you shouldn't accept any funds into your bank account or accept a check to deposit if it hasn't come from someone you personally know, friend or a relative that you're on very good terms with. Please don't accept anything into your bank account because you could be being used as what's called a money mule. So to launder that money on behalf of perhaps organized crime or someone with criminal intent. So we want to make sure that we are not accidentally getting looped into that kind of scheme on the basis of looking for a job.
What kind of recourse is there if you happen to fall prey to a scam like this?
Unfortunately, aside from alerting your bank that it's happened and reporting it to the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center, if you are out money, also reporting it to your local police, there is not much that anyone can do. Usually these fraudsters are located overseas, very difficult to track back where they were located originally from. So it is, unfortunately, you're going to just be out that money.
If I were to suspect that a job posting I find online or out in the world is indeed fraudulent, how would I best report that if I suspect that it is fraudulent or if I indeed have been a victim of such a fraud?
So those are two different kind of scenarios. If you apply to one of these jobs and they ask you to take money into your account in any manner, check or e-transfer without you having done any work. So you're not being paid for work that you've done. This isn't a paycheck. This is just a favor they're asking of you before you've completed work. Stop right there. That's going to be one of these kind of dog and pony shows. Report that to the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center right away. So if you've not accepted any money, you've stopped it at that level, all you have to do is report it to the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center. If you've gone ahead and accepted the money into your account and now you have the bank telling you that that was a fraudulent check or a fraudulent e-transfer, then you would have to report it to the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center, but as well report it to your local police.
We refer now to an expert on job postings and seeking employment at the WorkBC Center, Prince George Clayley Tanay. Here's Regional Manager Bev Schwartz. Do you have any tips on how someone would spot a job description that might not be legitimate?
Yeah, I mean, it can be difficult, definitely, to spot that kind of job description today that isn't legitimate, because there is all the bought advertisings and stuff like that, too, that look really original. I would say some red flags I think you could watch out for, as you said, if the job listing's too good to be true. That's definitely one. So that's kind of meaning that you see the job lead and maybe it's offering a really high salary with no education or work experience needed. That, I would say, is probably too good to be true. Most job leads, if you are in the higher salary expectations, they do require some training, some education, some certifications. So that's definitely one. Another red flag I think you could probably watch for is the communication of the job lead. Does it seem like it's unprofessional? Are there spelling mistakes in it? Is there poor grammar? Stuff like that. That's definitely a red flag, because proper job descriptions do not have those. And I guess lastly, I would say, does a job lead seem suspicious? Follow your gut. Your gut instinct is usually correct. So, for example, maybe you were answering a job lead and the employer, if they discuss any type of transferring of monies at all before you're hired, that's a good chance it's definitely a fraud. I would report it to our local police for sure, just to be safe. But no employer would ask for monies up front.
Corporal Jennifer Cooper of the Prince George RCMP corresponds with similar advice.
As tempting as that would be to accept, especially if you've maybe gone through a prolonged period of unemployment, money is getting a little tight, this seems like a really good benefit to you, stop right there. Trust your gut. If it's too good to be true, it likely is, and we need to stop and take a second thought. Maybe even phone a friend. Say, hey, what do you think about this? Do you think this is legitimate? Do you think this is a legitimate thing I should be doing? Talk it over with someone, because once you get past that excitement of getting something for nothing, that's when that sober realization will hopefully kick in, when you realize perhaps there could be a reason it's so easy.
Desperation can get the better part of us sometimes.
Definitely. Yeah. If you have been the victim of a fraud like this, or any type of fraud where you have lost money, there definitely tends to be a hesitancy on the part of victims to come forward and report that they have been a victim, largely for a sense of embarrassment. We hate to say that we were taken and that we've lost money. I was duped over Christmas into buying something online that turned out to be a fraud, and it was embarrassing to admit, because I should have known better, and I didn't, because I didn't take that second to think about how good a deal it was and think about maybe it being fake. Try and work past that embarrassment and report it to the Canadian Anti-Fraud Centre and report it to your local police, because that's the only way that we can track where these are happening and know where to put our resources to best try and stop these things from happening again. So stop fraudsters from being able to continue to create more victims. And that it can be very, very difficult, but we need people to make sure they are coming forward so we know where to put our resources.
Yeah.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca.
And, of course, job fraud like that isn't happening only in Prince George. It's happening everywhere. And I think the advice there that the officer was providing there right at the end, that if you get hired for a job and, you know, they want to send you money before you even started, that's a red flag for starters. And if they want some of it back, that's absolutely a scam. It just doesn't work like that.
100%.
Another scam you can watch out for that I've seen some stuff online is rental scams, where there's an apartment and it looks like a pretty good ad. They got photos and all sorts of stuff. But they want a deposit up front for various reasons. They say they can't show you that one. You know, they're out of town. They're, you know, away working in Europe. There's a whole bunch of excuses as why they can't show it to you, but, you know, they need to get that money, or But they want a deposit, which is the nature of the scam, because once they get the money, they disappear. Often, to try and suck you in, it's got a slightly unusually low rent. And if you're looking at something that seems like an oddly good deal, be very careful. In any situation where you can't visit the unit in person, they can't meet you there and let you in, is very high risk of being a scam, and you need to really probably just walk away from that, because it's not worth it. We're going to be up with Peter in just a second, but first we have Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Upland sandpipers cut a strange figure when they're perched on a fence. They're slender shorebirds that live far from the shore and have tiny heads on long necks. Their song is a whistle that rises and falls. Upland sandpipers need large areas of grassland habitat for their breeding grounds. In the eastern U.S., where prairies are sparse, they'll sometimes nest at a rural airport.
So when you're doing...
recognizing the expanse of grass beyond the tarmac as a place they can raise their young. The largest breeding populations of upland sandpipers are in the north central U.S., where they're still able to find grasslands without too many trees or bare ground. Loss of these habitats to row crop agriculture and shrubby plants invading prairies has caused their numbers to plummet over the past century. Upland sandpipers take wing to South America for the winter, where the grasslands of Argentina, Uruguay, and Brazil provide a similar habitat as the prairies they left behind. Preserving grasslands throughout their range will help ensure that the upland sandpiper's song continues to ring out. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is sponsored in memoriam of Alice Ashbaugh, a lifelong bird watcher and amateur ornithologist.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
All right, Peter.
Okay.
We're going to talk about aluminum.
Aluminum.
And steel and tariffs.
I'm just going to talk about aluminum. Okay. Steel is enough because, the United States gets 50% of their aluminum from their own making of it. 30% comes from Canada. 20% comes from other sources. In 2022, President Joe Biden requested Australia to export more aluminum to the United States. So it's sort of maybe we instead of doing counter tariffs, just say we're not going to sell you any aluminum. We'll see how that goes. But anyway, aluminum on the periodic table. Now, there's something called electron shells. And the outer shell is sort of what you got the 8-fit. And the famous one is H2O. So it's two hydrogen atoms, and they have an electron shell of one each. And oxygen has an outer shell of 6. So that's called the 8-fit. Now, aluminum has a 3, is the outer shell. And you're looking for the 8-fit. So actually, you need to have 8 atoms of aluminum to make pure aluminum. And there's something here on, okay. What's needed, because it's bauxite, which is a compound, and it's mined sometimes in the, we get it from Brazil for our smelter that we have in Kitimat in British Columbia. We've got one smelter in British Columbia, 8 in Quebec, And they make use of the hydroelectric power. They need a lot of it. And the reason is, I'm going to read something directly. The strength of the chemical bond between aluminum and oxygen is significantly stronger than the same bond between iron and oxygen. As a result, much more energy is required to split the bond and form the metal, or purify it. So how smelting is done, you take the bauxite and you smelt it to aluminum, which is another kind of compound, but a compound not found in the actual natural world. And then it produces pure aluminum from there. And the other thing is that the history of it, aluminum is sort of something of the modern era because, I already remember a lot of this. So it was around 1825 they found some process to have it. In fact, it used to be aluminum was more valuable but than gold because, of course, gold is a more valuable metal, but to have pure aluminum was hard to do. So in the 1890s, the invention of what I spoke of was sort of devised how you get pure aluminum from that. So the other thing is that it's sort of the first – it's not a transitory metal. It's a post-transitory metal.
What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, if this was television, I would present you the periodic table, and you have certain areas of the periodic table,
yeah.
And the ones that gold, iron, nickel on is a transitory metal, and actually aluminum is a post-transitory metal, but it's sort of the first. If you go by number, like we got hydrogen is one, and that means it's got just one shell, and that's one, and the helium is one, or so on.
Two
so it's the first one, if you go by the numbering that way, that it's the first you can make a coin out of, in a sense. You know, I mean, you can't make a coin out of sodium chloride. I don't know. That would be kind of a funny. Oh, by the way, so pure sodium makes water go on fire, and you can see that on the internet. But so what really happened was that about 20 or 40 years ago, there were 20 smelters in the United States. There's just four now. And I was looking at one of the a year ago, some sort of they were talking about, will we go to smelter in our community providing jobs? And they mentioned brownouts. Like, oh, well, sometimes the community has to put up with a few brownouts because it takes a lot of hydroelectric power. Now, what Alcan, which doesn't really exist, it was bought out, but it was a Quebec company.
And they're the ones who set up the Kitimat?
Yes, they
smelter?
Did.
Yeah.
So actually, I went there in 1966 to Kamano because Kamano is the power source for the smelter, and it's 85% of it is used for it. So they use 15% more for the grid. And the Kamano is 45 miles southeast of Kitimat. So I would assume also part of it is that Kitimat is a port, as it will, to the bauxite go that way. So it doesn't, the whole thing doesn't make any sense whatsoever for the tariffs because it's nonsensical at every level. Steel, I didn't really look into. They may have whatever, there could be an argument for that. But the aluminum, decisively not. The other thing is that it's, as I said, it's a post-transitory metal. But it kind of acts like it. It's the light. It's very light. The more you're up, like the helium balloon, of course, goes up in the air because it's light. It's lighter than the rest of the air, which oxygen is a bit heavier and so mm-hmm. on. So aluminum is the lightest thing that is like a metal. And it's just But it didn't really exist in its pure it's very common now. And it's very plentiful. It's very easy to get, as it were. And it doesn't rust, I don't think.
It does oxidize. You get that white, powdery sort of stuff on aluminum, and sometimes you can see it gets pitted, which may be a different. I think that might be a different reaction.
Well, that may make sense because
than the rust or the oxidization, but
yeah, in the natural world, of course, it just doesn't exist at all.
But I guess it does. You know, it takes that huge amount of electrical power to create it in its pure forms, and I guess that just isn't happening. Naturally.
Well, what's done in Canada is that, like, a hydroelectric dam is created for the smelter.
Yeah.
And I think what happened was that the last 40 years, it just made more sense for it to come from Canada more. Because it used to be, like, 20 smelters. And just, as I say, if you're going to ask the people around you to have a bit of a brownout, because we're making some aluminum here, it just doesn't. I don't see how you could, like, if the idea is to be protecting the aluminum industry or bringing it back, I don't see much sense in that.
If you don't have the capacity.
Well,
established to fill that demand locally or domestically in the United States.
And it doesn't seem like a process with, you know, the amount of investment that's needed, the amount of impact they have on a community that perhaps the American public wouldn't be super supportive. Maybe they'd rather they get it from Canada instead of trying to rebuild that industry potentially.
Right, because when I looked at it, sort of like not exactly the East Coast, but I was like, Kentucky has one and a few. And I said, where are they getting the power from? It just seemed kind of odd, the situation where they were.
Well, there's a reason they mine the bauxite, as you mentioned before, in Brazil, put it on a ship, drag it all the way up to the coast of BC to smelt it there, because not everywhere. You know, I don't think it's in any way cost effective to, for instance, use a fossil fuel, you know, powered energy plant to generate the energy. You know, with hydropower, once you've done the big initial investment of creating the dam, then the resultant power itself is really cheap, and that's what makes it practical to establish smelters here.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing is that China is using coal energy to do that, and it's like I guess Alcan Quebec has a lot of opportunities to make hydroelectric dams, or they've done it there. So, but one thing that happened about 30 years ago was that Alcan really was more interested in getting into the hydroelectric area, and a broadcaster on CKNW, Rafe Mayer, was incidental in stopping it, because it would have stopped a lot of the salmon runs and so on.
Right.
So, unfortunately, they were the bad guys that time around, which was sort of unfortunate, but it got sold, I think. And I was there in 66 at Camano. Now I got it straight. I said, it's in Kitimat. Why were we in Camano? Why did I see a bunch of hydroelectric stuff? But there was this lecture they had, and they passed around this big hourglass of aluminum. And now I understand what they were probably saying there. I didn't understand it at the age of 3, but I got it now.
So next week, we're going to be hearing about the first round of tariffs. I think the ones on steel and aluminum are supposed to be
12th, I think.
Yeah. One of the things, you know, during the first Trump administration, they also put tariffs on steel and aluminum, and they lasted about a year. One of the things I heard reported was that did lead to about 1,000 new jobs in the steel and aluminum industry. But the problem was that because, you know, those input materials, steel and aluminum, were at the bottom of the input chain, everything else is built on top of that, that those increased costs actually led to something like 75,000 lost jobs in other industries. So it's a challenging thing to get these tariffs to work the way they're hoping they're going to work.
Or just don't have them.
Yeah,
just,
you know.
Just let things be the way they are. Really.
All right. Well, we're out of time for this week here on Speak Up. Tune in tomorrow morning. Jesse's as we speak, putting together a great show for you there. Thanks to Liam for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
And Peter?
Yes. I was here.
Democracy Now! Is up right after this.